This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll hear from former Illinois Governor Jim Edgar. He talks about statesmanship and a new award to honor those working for the public good. The failure of a graduated income tax amendment in the state could mean education will pay a price. We'll hear more on that. We'll also learn how some high schoolers are coping with the loss of extracurricular activities. A park named after a slaveholder. Many wanted the name changed, but they were getting nowhere. Then two women took action.
We just sort of said, like, well, we can just change the name. Let's just go do it.
And we'll have more on the pandemic through the lens of survivors at a long-term care facility. Those stories and more this hour. Stay with us for Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, a Central Illinois Hospital administrator joins us to discuss the pandemic. We'll also hear a conversation with former Governor Jim Edgar. He'll talk about statesmanship and how two women decided to change the name of a park. They had to take matters into their own hands. Those stories and more on the way. Well, most of the new COVID-19 cases in Sangamon County are from community spread, people at house parties, at work, or in bars and restaurants. But that wasn't the case at the beginning of the pandemic, when most cases were happening in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. The Villas East, a nursing home outside of Springfield, experienced one of the first and deadliest outbreaks of COVID-19 in the county. Mary Hansen has the stories of the staff and residents who survived the outbreak.
About a week after the first few cases of COVID-19 were detected at the Villas, several residents were taken to the hospital. Sharon Reynolds, the administrator for the Villas, remembers the day vividly and how exhausted she was.
And so I can remember going home, getting a shower, and then coming back in, and it was dark here and seeing ambulances here, and it just, it's hard.
Reynolds holds back tears.
Those are just dark days. They're just dark times. These are the people that you care for.
The people she cares for are elderly, more prone to serious illness and death from the virus. Reynolds and her staff worked closely with the county health department and local physicians. They set up three wings of the nursing home: green zone for uninfected people, yellow for possibly exposed or in quarantine, and red, those sick with COVID-19. Reynolds checked the yellow zone often.
One time I called down there and it was, we have 9 temperatures, 9 new ones, and your heart just sinks.
Fevers are a symptom of COVID.
Because you knew, I'm not doing better, I'm getting worse. And you snowball. And you're just like, make it stop.
2 weeks into the outbreak, results from mass testing at the facility revealed that dozens more staff and residents had the virus. It was April 28th. The facility had now seen 81 cases, including 5 deaths. Sick residents were put in isolation in the red zone. The hallway to that wing was closed off with a sheet of plastic Visqueen, with one entrance and one exit. Infected staff were sent home to isolate. Some couldn't come back to work for 2 or 3 weeks. This stretched thin the employees who could work.
We were working such long hours that I would literally go home and just go to bed and get up and redo it day after day after day after day.
That's Lara Bowen, the director of social services. During the outbreak, she spent hours on the phone notifying the families of residents about new cases and updating them on their loved ones. She tells me what it was like at the end of those long days.
Well, you go home and strip naked in the garage and then, throw your clothes in a plastic bag and then the sanitize mode on your washing machine, and you go straight to the shower, and then you just kind of isolate yourself to your room.
She was living in the same house, but she had to keep her distance from her husband and 2 young daughters. This went on for almost 2 months.
Even though you test negative over and over and over again, you don't know what you've been inadvertently exposed to during that day.
While employees kept their distance from their families outside the facility, residents inside spent all their time in their rooms, alone, like Mary Hostetter. She's 96 years old, a proud Illinois farm girl, and retired high school librarian. She says she passed the time with jigsaw puzzles and novels.
Another one of the ladies and I trade books all back and forth. We read mostly good fiction.
A staff member would shuttle books between the two. Hostetter did contract COVID-19. She says she felt lousy, had little appetite, and lost some of her sense of taste. Her family dropped off food to try to tempt her into eating more and stopped by her window often to say hello.
They came in the morning when the sun was shining on my windows. About an hour is all we could handle, you know. It was better than nothing.
Because of privacy laws, staff couldn't share details about who is getting sick and dying. What Hostetter did find out, like when a friend she often ate lunch with died, was from the newspaper.
My nephew lives here in town, and he said his goal for at one point was to open up the paper and not have the villa on the front page.
The news coverage was hard for Sharon Reynolds, the administrator. People were outraged about the deaths and directed their anger at the villa's staff.
There was many people that told us we were awful, that we deserved to die. I mean, I personally was told, I hope you die.
Reynolds says people accused the villa's staff of bringing the coronavirus to the county. There's no evidence of that. There were cases of COVID-19 in the county before they were found at the villas. The Sangamon County Department of Public Health conducted an investigation, but were unable to determine the source for the outbreak. In May, the Illinois Department of Public Health did a compliance check of the nursing home's infection control protocols and noted a handful of issues. For example, a nursing assistant did not wear gloves when handing out masks to residents on the COVID-19 unit. Reynolds, the administrator, says the infractions were minor, and the nursing home came up with a plan to address them. Dr. Vidya Sundaresan is an infectious disease specialist who advised the villas during the outbreak. She says the errors are common for checks on nursing homes.
If it's in a COVID situation, you have to just exercise extra caution in terms of hand washing and other things. So you just need reminders all the time.
Sundaresan says all the policies and procedures she and health officials suggested, when to test, what disinfectants to use, how long to keep infected employees off of work, the villas implemented to the best of their ability. She says the rapid spread of the virus and high mortality rate were similar to what happened in nursing homes in New York, Washington State, and other places around the country at the time.
We had the experience of all those places, but when it happens locally, the first time that you go through it, it's a big learning curve for everybody.
Sundaresan says we also didn't understand the disease as well, nor possible treatments. Since then, outcomes for hospitalized patients have greatly improved. It was a heart-wrenching time at the villas, but eventually the outbreak began to wane. And one day in mid-May, Reynolds was surprised by a show of support. Hundreds of cars drove by the entrance to the facility, honking horns and displaying signs that said, "Villas Strong, and we love you."
That was the turning point where we felt like we were going to be okay. Like, there was a lot of people out there that did care.
By the end, 26 residents had died. Reynolds says she, the staff, and residents are now taking time to mourn. The villas held an outdoor memorial service for families in September. Bricks with the names of their loved ones line a fountain across from the entrance. The rage and vitriol has also faded, and that's allowed Reynolds time to reflect.
There wasn't anything I could have changed that I wasn't already doing. And I know that that's where my peace comes from. As I know, I gave it 110% to try to stop whatever we could.
Though things have definitely not gone back to normal, the villas has made progress. Residents can leave their rooms and gather in the dining room to share meals again. Reynolds says a beautician has even started working at the facility.
I don't think she quite got the magnitude of how important hair is to these ladies. They love it. And they literally were lined up around the corners.
Reynolds also put together a time capsule with photos of the residents and notes from her and staff members. And she's now taking time to counsel leaders at other care facilities going through outbreaks. She finds herself telling them all the same thing.
Drop to your knees and pray, and you will make it through this. And that's all I can say to them, is because I feel like somebody has to tell them that they're going to make it, because you don't feel like you're going to make it.
Reynolds credits her own staff with helping the villas make it, even as the sorrow and loss stay with them. I'm Mary Hansen.
Carle's five Central Illinois hospitals are seeing a rise in COVID-19 patients over the recent weeks. Hospital leaders say they're prepared to meet the growing need. Carle recently launched a program aimed at freeing up hospital beds by providing virtual monitoring to COVID-positive patients safely at home. Christine Herman spoke to the Carle Foundation Hospital President Lynn Barnes.
During the summer, we did see a bit of an increase, but nothing crazy. You know, maybe 12, you know, 15 patients over the summer months. And then in late August, maybe actually kind of early August, I think, we began to see a little bit of an increase. But wow, then in October, we've seen some pretty significant increases. Our case numbers were 483 during that week of October 4th through 10th. And now we tripled that to 1,500 in the most recent week.
So I understand it was in September when Carle Foundation Hospital launched a new program called COVID at Home. Can you talk about what made you decide to launch this program and what exactly it involves?
Well, what we saw was a growing number of patients coming to the hospital, coming to the ED, and being admitted in early September. So we thought to ourselves, you know, we need to do what we can to help people stay at home, be safe, and not be anxious. We established a program that when a patient comes to our emergency department in Urbana and they are diagnosed with COVID, and if the doctor doesn't, you know, it's kind of on the borderline, you know, do they need to be admitted or maybe they could go home? We take those patients and we enroll them in our COVID at home program. They get a kit that includes a pulse oximeter, which of course takes the percentage of oxygen that you have in your blood on your finger. And then they get a thermometer and they get some very clear instructions. So patients get to go home. They get to be carefully monitored by a virtual visit. And we say that a hospital bed, most people prefer being at home and they get great care. So far, we've had 82 patients enrolled in the program since the middle of September when we started it. And 77 of them have been discharged from the program, which is great. And of the 82, we only had about 15% of those that did have to be admitted.
The point of this program is that actually for many situations, as long as there's the right monitoring going on, many patients can recover safely at home.
Exactly. I think some people would feel that way. Well, just in case. But the whole goal of this program is to beat the just in case. You know what I mean? To you're talking every day with a patient.
That's Carle Foundation Hospital President Lynn Barnes speaking with Christine Herman. Chicago's Park District is renaming Douglas Park on the city's west side. The park will no longer be named after Stephen Douglas, 1S, the U.S. senator who profited from slavery, but after abolitionist Frederick Douglass, 2S's. The official name change is happening this month, but a year ago, someone began changing the park's signs on their own. Linda Lutton of member station WBEZ tracked them down.
The perpetrators of this crime would rather not say their names.
You could say they were old white ladies. That would be fine.
Yeah, vandal number one, vandal number two.
I meet them in the park near 19th and Sacramento. Both live nearby, and they tell me the story.
It had started to bother me, or I wonder, why is this park not named after Frederick Douglass instead of Stephen Douglass? It just seemed wrong and obvious.
A bunch of middle school students were responsible for getting her and others to think about this. The park sits in an African-American community.
It's an insult for the park to be named after a slaveholder.
Especially when it's so easy to rename the park for an African-American hero, the students at Village Leadership Academy argued. Just add an S.
Add an S is for the best.
They collected signatures, convinced the alderman, presented to the park district, which did nothing for almost 2 years.
So we just sort of said, like, well, we can just change the name. Let's just go do it.
Their first attempt involved paper, cut out S's.
I think we used the weld bond glue and we put a matte medium over.
That worked for about a month until there was a sleet storm.
Then we found the sad little S's laying on the ground. So we had to start again with a new technique.
Douglas Park is big, 170 acres. Signs with the park's name are at every entrance.
I was thinking we were going to do one sign and it will fall apart. And so what? We had done our job.
That is not what her co-conspirator had in mind.
It's like, no, we're going to do every sign. And if it falls apart, we're going to fix it. And we're always doing maintenance.
They altered and then maintained 47 signs for more than a year. The goal was to make the extra S look official, park issued. There were small signs, medium-sized signs.
And then the very large ones, the ones you had to get up on a ladder for. It's a sort of a risky situation.
Did I mention that this vandal is 72 years old? Vandal 1 is a spry 63.
So was this under, like, cover of darkness, or when was this?
Absolute broad daylight. And this is the place where we got caught. We actually got caught.
Vandal number 2 was up on the ladder.
She wasn't actually putting the S on yet. She had an old wooden T-square, very old school, kind of lining it up, because we wanted a good job. And this black SUV pulls up.
Uh-oh.
They roll down the window, and they're like, what are you ladies doing? And he's wearing a Park District staff shirt. And we had already done the other side, so the side right next to it was already changed.
Vandal 2, cool under pressure, played an excuse they'd thought up from the beginning.
And she was like, well, we're from the Art Institute, and we are studying typography in the parks. And you'd be surprised how interesting these signs and how many signs there are and what bad shape they're in. And he was like, oh, I thought you were up there putting up some kind of stickers.
Turns out this was the head of maintenance.
And if you were up there putting a sticker up there, you would be so busted because they're so hard to get off. So
never noticed the extra S. And if anyone from the park district did, they never took the S's down. News reports would mention from time to time that the signs had been changed, but this is the first time the vandals themselves have spoken.
We felt that what we were doing was supporting the work of the kids.
These young people were doing everything right for 3 years almost.
The middle school kids have been celebrating their victory. They say they felt uplifted seeing those extra S's in the park, knowing somebody was out there. New official Douglas Park signs with 2 S's are expected after the name change is finalized. Linda Lutton, WBEZ News.
Stick around on Statewide. We'll hear from former Governor Jim Edgar. He talks about his career and statesmanship. That's next. I'm Sean Crawford, and next on Statewide, we hear from former Illinois Governor Jim Edgar. The Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at SIU Carbondale is partnering with the U of I's Institute for Government and Public Affairs Edgar Fellows Program. They're highlighting leaders in the state working for the greater good. The Simon Edgar Award will shine a light on those working toward statesmanship. And the former governor spoke about the new award and his career with the Simon Institute's John Shaw.
Well, Governor, we could talk about your political career for a long, long time. You've done so many interesting things, but I want to touch on a couple things that I think kind of illuminate the award that we are going to be launching. And I want to go first to maybe one of your first jobs. I think it was your first job. You'd left Eastern. You were a legislative intern in Springfield, and you worked for Senator Arrington, Russell Arrington. And it's interesting because he's someone that maybe is not well known now, but I've heard both you and Senator Durbin say he is one of these kind of really kind of quietly consequential figures in Illinois history. So tell us a little bit about what it was like to start out with Senator Arrington, what it was like to be there in 69 when so many really consequential things were happening in Springfield.
Well, first of all, I would not say that he was quiet at his time. He was he was a short gentleman, but he made up for that with a lot of get up and go. He did not suffer fools well. And it was my really luck that I got assigned to be an intern with him in late 1968 and 69. And I got the job to sit next to him on the Senate floor. I kept a binder that had a comment, staff comments on every piece of legislation. And Senator Arrington was he developed staffing in the Illinois legislature. Along with Abner Mikva, they created the internship program. And then he was a big proponent of bringing in professional staffing into the legislature. But that was a great opportunity to see a lot of things that we're still dealing with today. I mean, he was the sponsor of the original income tax, created the Department of Transportation, Department of Law Enforcement. All those things happened in that session in 1969 in about 15 minutes because they had a deal. That's back when, and that's how I thought the process worked. You know, you'd argue and argue, but at the end of the session, Republicans and Democrats would sit down and they would compromise and they would solve the problems. And so that was a great session to start my career. The only thing it kind of spoiled me, it made me believe that state government was always going to solve the problems.
Well, Governor, let's talk about your time as Secretary of State, because it was, you were there for a decade. You know, we think of the Secretary of State's office as sort of a sleepy office that can be a political stepping stone. But I think of your time there and just the consequential things that happened. I mean, you guys modernized securities law in Illinois. You passed a whole new regime of DUI legislation, instituted, you know, mandatory auto insurance, you know, very aggressive on the literacy front, help launch and build a state library. Tell us about your approach there. I mean, you could have just kind of played it easy and just enjoyed it and gone around the state cutting ribbons, but you did some big consequential things from an office that we don't always think of as being consequential.
Well, I'd been appointed. I hadn't been elected. Nobody knew who I was. I was 34 years old from Charleston, Illinois. Jim Thompson had named me. I'd been his aide in the legislature. But nobody knew me. I knew I was going to have a tough time getting the nomination in my own party, probably, and then getting elected. So I knew I had to kind of hit the ground running. I couldn't just, you know, rely on my name being on the front door of the Secretary of State's office and everybody's billfold on their driver's license. So I had to be active. And one of the big problems at that time, now today people would find this hard to believe, nobody took drunk driving serious back then. In Illinois, they had tried to strengthen the laws and couldn't get on first base. And I remember I decided I wanted to do that first thing. And I had a lot of people say, well, that's suicide. You know, you're not going to get that done. You're just going to make people mad. Well, it turned out people began to realize how serious it was. And, you know, we got that done that first year. And that really kind of set the stage for me as Secretary of State. Now, probably the most, and that turned out not to be controversial. I mean, I had a few drunks mad at me and a few tavern owners. In fact, when I ran for governor, they would give a six pack of Budweiser to anybody to bring in 10 of my yard signs. But for most people, they agreed with that. We convinced them that was when MAD was created, and it turned out to be good timing, which is always important in government. Probably the toughest bill I had to pass, the one that I look back on and I thought is pretty close to being suicidal. We did not require senior citizens to be retested to get driver's license back then. And we had a couple occasions when a 70, 80-year-old would pile into a bunch of people and kill them, drive it. And it's obvious they should not have a driver's license. So I did propose and got passed right before I ran for governor, a bill that required seniors to be retested. Now, I mention this because I'm now approaching that age and I'm going to have to be retested. And I'm just thinking, who is that crazy Secretary of State? But that, to me, was extremely important for traffic safety.
Well, when you were here a couple of years ago, 2017, for our 20th anniversary, in your talk, you reflected on your years as governor, and you said running for governor was the hardest thing you've ever done. Tell us what it's like to run for governor of Illinois and how you work through all the various regional differences and partisan differences. Reflect on that, those campaigns.
Well, to understand, politics in Illinois is a blood sport. I mean, it's not easy. And Secretary of State's pretty easy. I mean, people, as I said, they don't get mad at you. You can do favors, give them a license plate, you know, whatever. And so that was kind of, as I look back on those races, those were very easy. Governor, everything is for keeps. And it's hard on the family. My kids went to high school in Chatham, which is a suburb of Springfield. And nobody ever got on them when I was Secretary of State. Of course, they didn't want to make them mad. I may not give them their driver's license. When I ran for governor, just running for governor, my kids started hearing things at school. I mean, there's a lot of pressure when you run for governor. This state is very diverse. I'm a downstater. I knew I had to sell myself not only to Chicago, but also to the suburbs where there's more potential Republican votes. I remember had a press conference early on when I became a candidate, and we had something was in the Secretary of State's office, but it didn't amount to much. And we got done with the press conference, that formal part of it, and I just started talking with the reporters as I always did. And some way we got on to taxes and funding schools. And I said, well, you know, I think we rely on the property tax way too much. We really ought to, you know, I think the income tax would be a better way to go. And I've said that many times. Again, the veteran reporters there, they knew this was just chit-chat and this wasn't anything they were going to write about. There was a new reporter for the Chicago Tribune there. And the next day in the headline of the Chicago Tribune, Edgar proposes another tax increase. And, you know, needless to say, I caught a lot of flack from members of my party and my staff. And it made me realize, okay, you're running for governor. This is the big time. You don't just say anything that comes to your mind. You've got to think through.
When you were down here a couple of years ago, you were talking about the role of governor, and you said probably the central thing they have to do is on the budget front, to present and implement a balanced budget. And, you know, everything else kind of flows from that central reality. And when you walked in, the budget was out of balance, a lot of unpaid bills. And in the course of your two terms, you left your successor with a very healthy surplus. And you kind of did it the old-fashioned way of additional revenues, spending cuts, yet at the same time investing in higher education, early childhood programs. Tell us how you kind of put together a fiscal policy. I think you earned the nickname Governor No, didn't you, for some of your spending cuts?
Well, you know, when I was running for office, I didn't think about it. I was going to be a fiscal conservative. I mean, I was always a moderate Republican. I just never thought too much about the budget part. I did have to take a position in that campaign, and this is why it was a tough race too. We had a temporary income tax that Mike Madigan had passed 2 years before. He loves temporary tax increases, and it expired my first year. And that was money that went to education and local government. Now, I thought local government was a lot better off than we were at the state level, but schools, I knew we couldn't cut schools and we didn't have any money. We had, when I walked in as governor, the largest budget deficit we'd ever had at that point. Now that looks minor compared to today, but we also had to deal with that temporary tax. And I'd campaign on saying, I'm going to make it permanent. And again, I had all my fellow Republicans just up in arms. So when I came in and saw how bad the state was, which I really didn't appreciate just how bad it was until during the transition, we figured it out. That's why a transition is a very important, you get the information. We're not here to talk about national things, but that's why it's important that President-elect Biden's team gets information, because fortunately we had that information early in the transition. So on day one, we knew that the budget was going to be our number one priority. And we did cut spending. We did say no a lot, but we began to work our way out of it and be able to do things like in higher education. First 2 years I was governor, I wasn't real popular on higher education campuses in Illinois because I actually had cut their budgets. Elementary and secondary got held constant. They didn't get an increase, they didn't get cut, but we did cut higher education. When we finally got money toward the end, then we gave higher education some pretty good increases. And fortunately, they remember that more than they remember. But when I went over to U of I after I left the governor's office to work there, some of them reminded me that they had gone up with a pay cut when I was first governor. Those are things we had to do. And people are pretty good out there if you're candid with them up front. And as I explained it to people, I said, it's like your own budget. You know, if you don't have the money, you got to cut out vacations. You can't buy the kids maybe a new bicycle. There's just things you can't do. And they understood that. As long as they thought you were being fair and everybody was being treated equal, to me, the priority was the budget. And so when we left office, we'd left $1.5 billion in the treasury. It never happened before, hadn't happened since. I think it took them about 3 months to spend it after I left. Today, it's in far worse shape than anything I had to deal with back in the 90s. And it's going to take a long time to dig out of this hole. And particularly after the tax amendment got defeated, I mean, that made the hole even bigger. It also did not create an environment that's going to make it easy to come up with new tax increases probably in the near future. So it's going to be a huge challenge for the governor. And the governor is the person responsible I mean, if the governor doesn't do the budget, nobody's going to do the budget. It's not in the nature of the legislature to cut and balance a budget. They want to spend. They got constituents. They want to take care of it. The governor's the person who has to lead. If the governor doesn't lead on the budget, it won't get done. Mike Madigan told me one time, he said, I'll follow you, but I'm following you. I'm not leading. On this thing, you've got to lead. And I said, fine, I'll lead. And he was pretty good most of the time on following me and backing me up on when we were trying to balance the budget.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the award that we're announcing today. It seemed to me that your animating mission is to take these really rising stars and help move them toward in the direction of statesmanship. Governor, let's reflect on that. Just the notion that an award that would look at exemplary service in state and local government in Illinois and kind of honor the best traditions of both parties. You know, neither party has a monopoly on truth or good government, but the best traditions of both parties.
Well, first, let me just say, I was very flattered when you asked me to be on the award with Paul Simon. I need to be second on that. You know, there's a lot of good people in government, in elected office, and it's hard to run for office. In fact, I jokingly say I don't think anybody should be governor or president that hasn't lost an election. Because, you know, anybody that goes through the electoral process has to really sacrifice to do that, because it's not easy. Not just running for governor, running for anything. So I think we sell short a lot of the people in elected office. We've got a lot of good Republicans and Democrats in Illinois, both at the state and local level, who are doing a good job. And I think it's important that we recognize that outstanding service, because people often just hear about those who fail or those who get in trouble or those who they disagree with. And most of the issues, both at the state and local level, are not partisan issues. They shouldn't be partisan issues. And so, and I can tell by dealing with the Edgar Fellows, there are some really bright people out there. And I listen to them talk about what they're doing, and they're working together on some issues, or they're working on issues that there's no way you can find a liberal or conservative bent to that. So I think it would be very important that we recognize those people. And so the public knows that there's some really good people there. And also, one of the things that I think is good about this, talking about having, we announced it at the Edgar Fellows, so these up-and-comers can see some of these who can serve as mentors to them or examples. People who did the tough thing, not the easy thing. Not always maybe in the short term the popular thing, but what they thought needed to be done. And as I said, I think there's many out there who are trying to do that, and we ought to encourage them, and we ought to recognize them. So I'm very excited about this award. I hope it's something that elected officials will hope that someday they might receive, because I think it is an indication that they've done a good job.
And as I think you and I have discussed, you know, we are not trying to seek and identify perfection. That's not what statesmanship is, but it is people who have a career that is focused on being effective, of doing hard things, and particularly of looking to the long term and not just trying to get by the next election.
One of my heroes is Winston Churchill. And there was someone who thought outside the box, was in the wilderness for many years of his career, but persevered. And I think sometimes we think people are either very good or they're very bad. My experience has been most of them, particularly going into public life, most everyone wants to do some good. Sometimes they get strayed on the wrong track, but you're right. We're not going to have perfection. Unfortunately, we have a lot of elected officials, or let me say not a lot, unfortunately. We have some who will put their political career on the line because they think it's the right thing to do. I think of three, four years ago, those 8 Republican legislators in the House who broke party ranks and got the wrath of their governor to vote for a budget that we hadn't had in 3 years. Those are the kind of things to me that I think happen that a lot of people don't know about in government that are crucial. And again, I think it's very important that we recognize those achievements and those profiles and courage.
Former Illinois Governor Jim Edgar speaking with John Shaw, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute. The new Simon Edgar Award will honor statesmanship in Illinois. You're listening to Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum was planning a big week, but now it's closed for at least a month because of rising coronavirus cases. Governor Pritzker announced new restrictions that impact museums and many other locations. The Presidential Museum had planned to have one of the rare handwritten copies of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address go on public display. Now that has been postponed until next year. The anniversary of the speech was this week. Still ahead here on Statewide, we'll be talking about one of those high school sports that's been allowed to take place, cross country. But first, Illinois school districts face potential cuts to state funding. That is in the wake of voters rejecting a ballot initiative for a graduated income tax. If approved, it would have pumped billions of dollars into the state treasury by raising taxes on Illinois' highest earners. Robin Staines is the president of Advance Illinois, a public education advocacy organization. Since the state adopted its evidence-based funding formula back in 2017, Staines says they've invested $900 million into Illinois' poorest schools. Still, about half of the districts in Illinois have less than 70% of the funding they need. Staines spoke with our education reporter Lee Gaines about the rejection of the tax and its implications for school funding.
It is hard for me, without some additional revenue, be it federal or be it some alternative state revenue strategy, it's hard to believe that the governor isn't right when he says there will be cuts and they will be painful. If there are cuts, there is no way to protect education because education is a third of the discretionary budget.
So what does the future of evidence-based funding look like without the graduated income tax? And what does that mean for school administrators, for teachers, and for students, particularly at these schools that are still not at the funding level they need to be at, according to the formula?
You know, one, I want to make sure your listeners understand that the dollars we put into the evidence-based formula are cumulative. So there is 900 plus million additional dollars in the system even now when we flat funded. That's the good news, that those districts that got those dollars, those additional dollars, can continue to count on those dollars unless we cut. And those dollars have made a powerful difference, particularly at the districts that have been the most underfunded. And it was only just after this third year where the state was doing exactly what it said it was going to do. It said it was going to put these new dollars into the formula. It was doing that. It had done it for 3 years. And I think schools were finally really trusting, okay, I've dug myself out of my financial hole. I can really make these programmatic decisions and not have to worry that the financial rug's going to be yanked out from under me. And so the timing of this, I think, is challenging, not just because there's concern that dollars will be taken away, but because when districts are uncertain, they are less likely to make the programmatic and staffing investments that they need and that students need. And so I think what breaks my heart is that schools may feel like, okay, I don't know if cuts are coming. So I, instead of hiring that additional counselor at this time when students' mental health and well-being is so under attack, instead of hiring that additional social worker or counselor, I'm going to keep that money in the bank because I don't trust that there may not be cuts coming.
So not to bum our listeners out too much here, but what are you most concerned about when you look at the future of education funding in Illinois?
One way or another, we need revenue, and that's going to be some combination, I hope, of the economy rebounding and just sort of being in a healthier place. Obviously, the fair tax was one way to generate additional revenue. It is not the only way. The fact that over half of our school children are in districts with less than 70% of the dollars they need to do the job the way it needs to be done should worry everybody about the future of the state. That is not only compromising the future of those individual students, but it's putting our own growth and our own stability at issue as a state. We have to come to grips with that. We cannot sustain that. And we're living the results of that. The number of students who are where they need to be in terms of reading at grade level by that very important third and fourth grade year is around a third. And that's about the number of districts that have the dollars they need. It's eerily related. And there is a growing body of deep research that says if you want to really do right by kids, getting the dollars to the districts that need them most over a sustained period of time is an incredibly important driver of better, stronger student growth and success. And we were on that path. And we were, you know, it is heartbreaking that we've hit a block. It is just heartbreaking.
That's education reporter Lee Gaines talking with Robin Staines of Advance Illinois about the future of education funding in Illinois. The pandemic has sidelined a lot of activities high schoolers look forward to, such as homecoming dances and extracurricular activities, but that's not stopping some from enjoying the milestones of teenage life. Susie Ahn with WBEZ brings us an update on two high school juniors.
Hi.
Hi.
It's another day in Jordan King's virtual high school. She's in a breakout room for a small group discussion in her Spanish class.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. My internet was cutting out a little bit, so.
At first, the Naperville North High School junior said breakout rooms were awkward, full of silent moments and kids jumping off the call because the teacher wasn't watching. But now, Jordan says, at least for her, she settled into the new normal of the pandemic. She recently went back to school in person for a couple of hours for the PSAT, the standardized test that juniors take as a precursor to the SAT.
I really did not want to go into school. I was like, I really don't want to see these people. But it was okay. I was there to take a test, so I was out pretty fast.
Unlike previous years, students had to undergo a health screening and sign a waiver before coming to the school building. And instead of the whole class crowding into a field house, students were spread out at their own table in a bunch of different classrooms.
I think it minimized the anxiety that you feel. Being in like such a large place taking a standardized test is really nerve-wracking. So being in like a smaller space, taking it like at your own single table really made me feel better.
The pandemic didn't stop her from taking this test, and it didn't stop her from completing a rite of passage for 16-year-olds, getting her driver's license. Jordan's mostly using it to drive to her part-time job as a receptionist. But the real reason for getting her license?
So that I could get coffee and stuff like that before school on, like, asynchronous days. It just sounds so amazing. So.
Several miles away in the northern suburb of Zion, junior Leslie Gomez also hit her 16-year-old milestone. She's using her license to drive to her new job, working at a drive-in eatery near her house.
I kind of just want to get a job so I can, like, start paying for my own things. Yeah, the money's just, like, basically for me or to, like, sometimes help around.
And the job comes with perks. She gets to work with one of her good friends, and every once in a while, she gets to take home some treats.
I only took, like, a cup of ice cream, but it was for my sister because she told me to take something home for her, so that's all I bought her.
While Leslie still doesn't like remote learning, she does like how it is easier to juggle the job with her schoolwork. But overall, it's been difficult.
Like, my parents and, like, some people were telling me that supposedly junior year is, like, the hardest year. But right now, since we're, like, online, I feel like it's hard for everyone.
Junior year is often pegged as the most crucial year for students who are planning to go to college. But Leslie thinks it's difficult for everyone. Both she and her sister, who is a freshman, are getting more work than they would if they were at school in person. She's been focusing on that rather than preparing to apply for college. Meanwhile, in Naperville, Jordan says she actually prefers virtual school to in-person. Her school had planned to return to some in-person learning, but has held off because of an increase in COVID-19 cases.
Usually, like, I'm so scared to ask questions in class because I'm always scared, like, oh my gosh, this is going to be a stupid question or something like that. But now, like, I ask, like, 16,000 questions in math all the time because you can private message a teacher in Zoom.
Both Jordan and Leslie have wrapped up their first quarter of school, and for the time being, their classes will stay remote. Often the distance is winter vacation. And the question remains whether they'll ever return to school in person this year. Susie Ahn, WBEZ News.
Cross country was one of the few high school sports to have a semi-normal season this fall. Peter Medlin talked with the Winnebago girls cross country team and coaches about what the COVID season was like for them.
For the first time in over 20 years, coaches Janet and Joe Erb were nowhere to be seen at their Winnebago girls team's regional meet. Then again, some of their runners weren't there either. Just days before regionals, members of the team and coaching staff came in close contact with someone who had tested positive for COVID-19. Although protocols had been in place, races were smaller, and their season schedule had been altered, this was the first time the virus directly impacted the team, Janet Erb said.
Thank goodness none of us actually ever had any symptoms.
The Erbs have two daughters on the team who also had to quarantine. And Joe said they had to find a way to watch the race from home.
We had one of our runners, her parents had Facebook Live. And so the younger sister, who happens to be one of my students, was recording for us.
It was regionals, and three of their top five runners were in quarantine. That means runners who wouldn't have raced got thrust into a crucial spot with the season in the balance. Sophia Martino is a junior on the team. She's normally the seventh runner, but had to move into a faster flight. Plus, she'd spent the whole year rehabbing from a dislocated kneecap, which had already slowed her down.
It was very weird, and I was a lot more responsibility because I had to step up from being the seventh runner to being the fourth runner.
Joe said seniors who thought their career was over got one last chance to run.
Our ninth girl was a freshman. She was 16th in the regional. And, you know, she hasn't gotten to run varsity all year because, you know, she's got these other teammates. And I kept telling her, listen, you're a varsity runner.
And the Winnebago girls still won regionals with their senior leader, Natalia Martino, running away with first place. Joe says of all his years as a coach, this is the meet that made him sit back and say, wow.
Well, I think the older I get, the more I think that these are the types of things that you carry with you in life is, you know, those kids, when called upon, stepped up and were able to perform well because they prepared well all season.
The IHSA canceled the cross-country state tournament. So no matter how fast they were, the Winnebago girls would never have a shot to repeat as state champions. But they still had sectionals, the final official race of the year, to defend their title. And with all their runners back from quarantine, Janet says they were dominant.
We actually perfect scored the meet.
She says it's rare for a team to get a perfect score in any meet, let alone a sectional. The three top five girls got out of quarantine that morning and all finished in the top 10. They had six girls awarded all sectional. Sophia Martino said it felt different this year.
Sectionals was obviously a bigger deal than last year, but it also felt really weird.
And she says the staggered, flighted races in place because of COVID-19 to avoid packs of runners racing shoulder to shoulder felt almost lonely at times. She often found herself running a race with maybe one teammate, but sometimes by herself. With no one to race against, the mental side of running is even more vital. Even though sectionals were the last official IHSA race, the Shazam Racing Company invited top teams to participate in its version of a state meet. Overall, Janet says she was constantly impressed by the composure her team showed. In an unprecedented season, no one was sure what even happened, let alone finish.
They could have easily been, hey, we should be state champs and we didn't get an official state meet, and been, you know, like disappointed the whole time and used excuses, but they just said, we're going to make the best of whatever we have.
Runners had their track season canceled in the spring, so the phrase, run every race like it's your last, felt real and urgent in a way it might not have pre-pandemic. Group experiences and camaraderie are tough to come by during COVID-19, so Joe says he thinks the season bonded the team in a special way beyond running. And even though they don't have a trophy to prove it, he's confident they would have been state champs. As Sophia put it,
don't take it for granted, because you never know what might happen. You might get injured, or you might have a worldwide pandemic.
Plenty of Illinois student athletes hoped cross country and golf finishing might mean winter sports could go on as well. But with COVID-19 numbers continuing to rise across the state and increasing mitigation measures in place, it's uncertain if those athletes will suit up at all. I'm Peter Medlin.
For the first time in more than 70 years, one of the oldest football rivalries in college sports will not be renewed. The annual football game between two small colleges in western Illinois, Knox and Monmouth, has been called off, as Herb Trix explains.
And the reason, of course, is the pandemic. In fact, this will be only the second time the Knox-Monmouth game has been missed since 1888. Previously, only World War II could get in the way of the annual football game in 1943 through 45. Because the game is played each year near Thanksgiving, the winner takes home the Bronze Turkey Trophy, once named by ESPN to its list of strangest rivalry trophies. Monmouth currently leads in the series with 70 wins, including its current 21-game winning streak. Knox has won 50, and they've tied 10 times. I'm Herb Trix.
And that's that's all the time we have for Statewide this week. We'll be back next time with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this episode or past shows, you can find them at statewideshow.com, and you can like us on Facebook and keep up with the program each week. Have a happy and safe Thanksgiving. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations. Thank you.